"Hey, this is John Grise. I played Uncle Rico. When everybody's asleep and the lights are out, I go to Mr. Media. I don't watch porn."
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to Charles Ardye, editor of the Hard Case Crime Detective Fiction series. His imprint's latest book is The Cocktail Waitress, the lost final novel of writer James M. Cain, author of Mildred Pierce, The Postman Always Rings Twice, and my personal favorite, Double Indemnity. Stick around, and please, tip your scantily clothed waitresses appropriately, you cheapskates! This is Bob Andelman, and this is the Mr. Media Interview, brought to you today by the Stitcher app for mobile devices. Give it a test drive today at stitcher.com/mrmedia, Mr. Media. I love this free radio app, and I think you will too. stitcher.com/mrmedia. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of bar and restaurant employees who think they'll be drinking for half price after today's show in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. I honestly can't remember which came first. Did I see the steamy remake of The Postman Always Rings Twice with Jack Nicholson and Jessica Lange before I found the ancient paperback versions of Double Indemnity and Mildred Pierce at the old book swap in Milltown, New Jersey? Or was it the other way around? Either way, the teenage me was astonished by the twisted humanity found in the work of James M. Cain. And of course, the postman scene on the kitchen table with Nicholson and Lang, well, that still blows my mind today. And whether it was experienced in yellowed print or up on the silver screen, Cain's work was always recognizable. Well, 35 years after Cain's death, his final manuscript, his lost manuscript as it is being touted, turned up. The Cocktail Waitress was a story Cain kicked around for several years, changing, tinkering, never quite satisfied with it. Enter Charles Ardye, editor of the Hard Case Crime publishing imprint. Ardye took Cain's multiple drafts and notes and made the best book he could of it. It's not perfect, but it's an unexpected taste of Cain that any fan of the writer will find hard to resist. Ardye is here to talk about Cain, his cocktail waitress, and the rising hard case crime line itself. Charles Ardye, welcome to Mr. Media.
It's a great pleasure, Mr. Media.
Glad to have you here. I'm obviously familiar with Cain, like Cain a lot.
Clearly. I mean, your experience sounds a lot like mine. I didn't know Cain. I'd read a lot of crime fiction. I found one tattered copy of Double Indemnity on a bookstore table out front, you know, the cheap table. And I was a freshman in college. I grabbed it and I thought, well, it's thin. I can read it quickly. It may not be good, but at least it's short. And it blew me away. It was fantastic. And I just had to read more Cain. I hunted down, this was before the internet, so it wasn't that easy to hunt down Cain's obscure novels, but I hunted down every novel the man had published and I read them all. And, you know, some were better, some were worse. He had three classics, and everything else was dramatically below that level. But then, frankly, everything else written by any other author was below that level.
Yeah.
So I mainlined Cain. And then when I found out years later that there was an unpublished Cain left, I had to find it. Not so easy, but I had to try. And 9 years later, I finally got it.
Well, okay, so let's just jump right into that. You created the opening. How does a lost novel surface? How do you hear about it? I mean, is it a literary archaeology? What, you know, tell folks the story.
Very much so. You know, look, it depends on how it was lost and why. If the author burned the only copy, good luck. But in the case of Cain, he died with no heirs. He had no children. He was married four times, but I believe his wives all predeceased him, or in any event, they weren't around. He had papers, and his landlady inherited them and then sent them off to the Library of Congress. And so somewhere deep in the bowels of the Library of Congress are something like 100 boxes of Cain's papers. And this is everything from correspondence to typescripts to random, you know, galleys and that sort of thing. I didn't think to look there at first, although that was ultimately where I found a lot of the material. I started with rare book collectors, people like Otto Penzler, who were fans of Cain and had a lot of manuscripts. I started with book dealers. I started with editors. I went to the agency, the literary agent that represented the Kane estate, and I asked all of them if they knew of this book, The Cocktail Waitress, and the answer was no. They had heard of it in some cases because Kane had given interviews at the end of his life in which he said, I'm working on a new book. I just finished a new book. It's called The Cocktail Waitress. It's about this waitress who gets a $50,000 tip from a customer. That was the premise in his mind, which does happen in the book, although it's really not the central event. But in any event, we knew the book existed, but nobody had a copy, and I spent years trying to track it down. And then finally, I was talking to one of my agents. I do some writing for television in Hollywood, and my agent's a man named Joel Gottler, and he said, oh, you know, I inherited the files of an old-time Hollywood agent named H.N. Swanson, who used to represent Faulkner and Fitzgerald, and by the way, Kane. I said, could you just take a look in his files and see if you have anything? I didn't expect the book to be there, but I thought maybe there would be some reference to it in some letter or something. And he looked, and within days I got a package in the mail that had the manuscript of The Cocktail Waitress, and it had just been sitting there in his filing cabinet all this time. Now, that was the first step. And the thing is that that typescript was just one of several different drafts. It was complete. It had a beginning, middle, and end. It ended with the words, the end, written in an odd diagonal type. I mean, you could tell Kane was thrilled at having finished the book because he didn't just type the end. He wrote T, then return, space, H, return, space. But then I did think of looking in the Library of Congress and found some handwritten manuscripts and first draft, second draft, drafts that petered out after 100 pages, after one page, and realized that I had a much bigger editing challenge putting this together than I had originally expected. Very different from the challenge where an author leaves the book unfinished, like Fitzgerald left The Last Tycoon. It just ends halfway through, and then you have to decide what to do. In this case, we had finished drafts, but more than one. So what do you do? Different challenge.
And was this the first time you had pursued sort of a lost novel?
No, we'd done several, but it was the first that was of this scale and profile. We did two posthumous novels by Donald E. Westlake, who was one of our authors while he was alive. We did a book called Memory that his old friend Lawrence Block remembered reading when he wrote it in manuscript form back in the 60s, but Don showed it to his agent, who said, this is too ambitious and literary and existential and philosophical. No one wants that from you. Would you write some more of those short crime novels that you're good at? So he stuck it in a drawer and never published it. It's really a terrific book, and Larry turned onto that. And there was another one that Max Allen Collins, who I know you've talked to, said was one that Don had sent him in the 80s but decided never to publish because the premise was too similar to Martin Scorsese's movie, The King of Comedy. So he shelved that. So there were two Westlakes, but I also had books by Lester Dent, who was the creator of Doc Savage.
My favorite. Yep.
So, oh, cool. Not that many people remember Lester Dent.
I read them all.
Well, you're going to read another one if you haven't read Honey in His Mouth. It's really a fun book. That one he sent to publishers and they wouldn't buy, and I could tell why. You know, you saw the manuscript and you could understand there was something fundamentally broken about the ending. But Will Murray, who represents the Dent estate, and I sat down, figured out what we would have told Dent if he was alive, and hopefully he would have edited it, but the two of us edited it instead, and it ended up being a much stronger book, and we published it. I'm very proud of it. Roger Zelazny, the science fiction writer, David Dodge, who wrote To Catch a Thief, all of these had posthumous novels published in hard case crime. Now, I don't want to make it sound like that's the only thing we do.
No, it's not. I know. Yeah.
We published 80 books, and maybe 7 of them have been posthumous, but it is something of a specialty of ours. And so by the time we got to Kane, it wasn't the first time. I wasn't intimidated by it, although Kane was one of my heroes as a young reader, and so getting to work on Kane's final novel was not just a privilege, but a little bit butterflies in the stomach inducing.
And what kind of shape was it in? Now, I should tell folks that at the end of the book, because the book is out, at the end of the book, you do have a sort of lengthy editor's note that explains the process a bit. So we're giving up a little bit of what's at the end of the book after you've read the novel. So, you know, I
well, that's nobody wants The Cocktail Waitress by James M. Cain to read an afterword by Charles Ardai, although I was happy to write it. I think the short answer to your question, which is in what shape was it, was that the opening chapters were in outstanding shape. They needed very little editing. The closing chapters needed more, and this isn't a surprise. For one thing, Kane had the opportunity to work over the opening chapters many times. So, for instance, if there were 10 different drafts, that's 10 different versions of the opening chapters, but there were maybe only 2 or 3 versions of the closing chapters, so he just spent less time on it. And also, in some of the interviews and his correspondence, he expressed himself a dissatisfaction, as I think you mentioned earlier, with the ending of the book. He was never quite comfortable that he had nailed it, and I think the reason is that he hadn't. I think he had worked on a number of variations, but he had never quite reaped the harvest of the seeds he had planted earlier in the book. And sometimes it takes a new pair of eyes looking at something. Even with our living authors, I go back to them sometimes and I say, you realize this is the book you were writing, and it got off track. You got distracted, or in any event, somehow you didn't finish it the way it was meant to be finished. As an example, the Dent book, for example, is about a man who is a dead ringer for a South American dictator. He looks exactly like a South American dictator, except that he lacks a scar on his face, and so he has plastic surgery to have the scar added, and now he can impersonate the South American dictator. The rest of the book goes on, and we get to the climax, and without spoiling the ending, in the original Dent manuscript, he never made use of the fact that this man looks like a South American dictator. He just dropped it. Now, how do you do that? You know, the reader's just not going to be satisfied unless you pay that off in some way. And it's just obvious that you have to. And in fact, his climax permitted the payoff. He just didn't do it. And so Will and I just, you know, made actually a very small number of changes. It might have been 2 pages worth of changes out of 200, but they were the 2 pages you needed so that the ending was satisfying. With Kane, it was very clear to me as a reader of Kane, who knew where his plots went and how his mind worked, and as a mystery writer myself, where he was going with some of these pieces, and he just didn't pay them off as satisfyingly as I think he would have wanted to. This is why, as I quote in the afterword, he told his editor, if you work with me, you have to get used to it. I work on an ending ceaselessly. Well, if he had maybe another 2 or 3 years, maybe he would have gotten it. We did some work. I shouldn't say we. I did some work on it to try to pull out onto the page some of the things that he had left unspoken. But you know, the vast majority of the words in the book are Kane's, and the vast majority of Kane's words are in the book. It's really just a question of editing.
Charles, what's the difference between you coming in as editor, I'm using that particular title, as the editor on this Kane book, The Cocktail Waitress, and Max Allen Collins coming in as a co-author or with, I don't remember if it was a with or an and credit on that book, Lady Go Die, which was Mickey Spillane's unpublished sequel to I, the Jury.
But Collins's credit has changed over the course of his interactions with Spillane. And he and Spillane were close friends, and Mickey specifically asked him to complete his unfinished work. And the first book that he worked on was a book for us called Dead Street. And there, the front cover just said Mickey Spillane, but the title page said Mickey Spillane prepared for publication by Max Allen Collins. And we could have done that with The Cocktail Waitress, Cocktail Waitress by James M. Kane, prepared for publication by. That's more of an editing credit. What did that mean in the case of Dead Street? It meant that Mickey had written 8 of the book's 11 chapters entirely on his own. He and Max had talked about what the last chapters would be, but he died before he could write them. Max wrote the last 3 chapters, but very much to the instruction of, I mean, he didn't spell out exactly what would happen in those chapters, but he had given Max the request to finish it. And so there it was just prepared for publication by. Then I think the first Mike Hammer, which was The Goliath Bone, might have been with, or in any event, it was Mickey Spillane in big type and Max Allen Collins in little type. But as Max has completed books by Mickey, where the contribution that Mickey left behind was less and less, once you get to the point where more than half the book is original prose by Max Allen Collins, it's only fair that he share equal credit. And so that's what you're starting to see with the Mike Hammer books. I certainly don't deserve equal credit with James M. Kane for The Cocktail Waitress. It's far from being half my words. Therefore, just having the appropriate acknowledgement be that I edited it seemed fair.
I'm wondering if, like in the case of Max and Mickey, if part of what's allowed it to evolve is lack of reader resistance to the fact that Max has been involved.
Part of it, I think that's true, and I think Max is a bit of a celebrity author in his own right. He has many thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of fans. He's known for the original graphic novel that became Road to Perdition. He wrote the Dick Tracy newspaper comic strip for a decade. He has many credits to his own credit. And I think it makes sense to put him on an equal footing with Mickey Spillane. Now, I'm proud of my work, and I've won some awards, and that's terrific. But claiming that I'm on a comparable footing to James M. Kane would be arrogance in the extreme. So maybe I was excessively modest, but I thought I was really just doing the same kind of work that I've done for any number of our living authors. And we don't publish those books as by Dominic Stansberry and Charles Ardai. It's just Dominic Stansberry edited by. So I wouldn't have dreamed of putting my name on it.
Now, I'm going to tell you my one criticism of the book, I want to tell you this not because I want to be provocative, but because I want to see I want to see what the response is. The one thing that rubbed me the wrong way about the Kane book, I like the plot, I like the story, I like the sass of Joan, the protagonist, but it just seemed to me that a lot of times, not so much when, and I should explain to people that the story is first person. It's her telling her story, but a lot of times, her dialogue, I just thought it sounded like. In a lot of places, and I'm sorry, I don't have examples in front of me, but if I need to, I can go find them. But it seemed to me that a lot of the dialogue seemed like an old man trying to imagine what a woman sounded like without ever having heard a woman speak. It was right. Stiff. It was
it's still in a very peculiar way. Yeah. And I exactly what you're talking about. And it's interesting because where I had to fill in pieces of dialogue, and sometimes it was necessary, I had to capture that voice because, of course, it had to be consistent with the dialogue that Kane had written. So I had a firsthand opportunity to learn just how stilted it was. It's interesting because Kane was known for his dialogue, although I remember Raymond Chandler saying when Chandler worked on the screenplay for Double Indemnity, Kane's dialogue is great for the page but doesn't work when you put it in someone's mouth. You can't put someone in front of a camera and have them speak Kane's dialogue because it just sounds completely unnatural. And Kane then acknowledged that. I think Kane's patois has never been naturalistic. It's not like Elmore Leonard, where when you hear when you read the line, you can almost hear the person saying it. Mm-hmm. It's Kane talk, and Kane talk is not actual human speak. But as he got older, it got more peculiar. And so the early books, the real classics, Double Indemnity and Postman, it's still not normal human speech, but it somehow feels like it is. And it feels convincingly human. And when you get to the end of his life, I think it had evolved. I think his ear had changed. He was an old man, so it's not shocking that it sounds like an old man. Of course, he knew what women sounded like. He was married four times. But that doesn't guarantee that he can reproduce it on the page. So I know exactly what you're talking about. So then the question is that to the book's detriment or to its benefit? And that depends on each reader's reaction to it. If you find it off-putting and it keeps you at a distance, then the answer is no. But I found as I worked on the book and as I read it, probably whatever number I had of times I had to read it, five, six times, I found that it was sort of seductive, and it's an almost Southern flavor to it. It almost has an old-fashioned chatty quality that is a little ornate. It's not the stripped-down, bare quality that you have in Postman, but I found it tasty. You know, it was like a tasty meal, but different readers will feel differently about it, of course. Yeah. And a few phrases here and there that were just very old-fashioned that I took out. I edited those out.
I mean, I kept thinking, I'm trying to remember, the book, why am I thinking that the book takes place in like Baltimore or somewhere?
It's Maryland, that's
Maryland.
Right.
Yeah, okay. So I kept thinking, okay, I've known people from Maryland. I mean, I've been on this planet a while. I just never heard anyone from any part of the country talk like this. Yeah. And I thought, yeah, you know, I mean, I don't know. But other than that, yeah. But okay, so I'm not telling you anything that surprises you.
So I could have gone through it line by line and replaced Kane's words with something that was a conscious imitation of Postman, very stripped down, very bare. That feels like it would have been more disrespectful to the author than allowing people to read his actual language, even if it's a bit stilted and peculiar. So that was the choice I made. But another editor could easily have done the opposite. But it would have involved more more demolition and renovation than I thought people really wanted.
Yeah, that's fair. I wondered. You know, that's why I was curious to get your response. I wondered. I mean, in my work, you know, Mr. Media is more hobby than anything. I write nonfiction and work with. I'm basically a co-author, and I work with a lot of people. And my job is to get down. To hear them and to get down on paper the way that they talk, and so that when you read their book, you feel like they're talking to you. Yeah, and so you know, and always to keep my own voice out of it. And so I thought, okay, maybe I'm being too sensitive to it. But if you were aware of it, then I feel like okay, it was a fair.
Some reviewers have mentioned it as well. There's some turns of phrase that are just delicious, but there are also some sentences that are peculiar and old-fashioned. I'm reminded in some ways of Cornell Woolrich, and I don't know if you've read Woolrich, who wrote Rear Window and The Bride Wore Black, and dozens of books that were real and short stories that were really terrific. But he had his own weird purple way of writing. Either you like it or you don't like it, but no one else on earth has ever written like it. Or Edgar Allan Poe. You know, you read Poe or Lovecraft, it's not the way people talk, and it's certainly not the way people write prose today, but it's also, in this way, delicious. So I think it's funny that Cain, who was known for being so spare, ended up being purple at the end of his life. But it's a shade of purple I like, so there you go.
Well, it was interesting. The last thing I'll say about it is that the two things that seemed opposing to me was that there's a lot of sexual reference and sex talk that, again, it struck me the way an old man would, who hadn't had sex in maybe 20 or 30 years, would be writing about it. And in a way, and then trying to think, okay, and it's got to be a woman talking about it. But those references and that dialogue seem very different from some of the other things. It was just, I don't know.
Yeah, this is interesting. It's there were a couple of, not too many. I'd say in the entire book, maybe there were two places where I thought Cain was striving to be as controversial and shocking as he was known for being in his. So there were one or two places in Postman Always Rings Twice that were shocking and scandalous, and people mentioned them at the time as gutter language. And here, Cain was writing in the 70s. Of course, that's an entirely different world. This is the time of Studio 54 and Plato's Retreat, and it's very hard to shock the reader in the 70s. And so there were a few places where I thought Cain was trying very hard to do so. Again, the question was, do you leave it in or take it out? Is it embarrassing to have it in there? I thought, you know what, leave it in there. Let see what Cain was really like.
It definitely felt of an age, and that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, so before we finish, I got to ask you. I mean, are there more lost novels coming up from any other authors? Do you have any more of these in the?
There won't be more by Cain. He did have one or two other manuscripts that, as far as I know, have never seen the light of day, but they weren't crime novels. I think he wrote a children's book about a girl and a tiger, and he wrote a historical book. But those wouldn't be right for us, even if they'd be right for someone else. There are lost novels that we're cooking up, but we haven't signed a contract for any of them. There's one, in fact, as soon as I get off the phone with you, I'm getting on the phone with the widow of an author whose name I won't use, but who is something of a cult figure, both in the crime field and in the film community, and he had a lost novel that would also require a certain amount of editing. So I think if we can, each year we're going to bring back at least one lost novel to go hand in hand with all the brand new stuff we do. But next year's big book, of course, will be Stephen King's new novel for us. He wrote a book called Joyland. He wrote a book for us about 8 years ago called The Colorado Kid, which was the basis for
Haven.
The TV Haven, that's right, which I'm one of the writers and producers on. Very excited. We just started our third year. And this book is set in a North Carolina amusement park. It's sort of a Carney novel. It's set in 1973, and it's just a beautiful book. That will be by far the most profile book we've ever done. It's not a lost novel, but it's a new novel, so that's in some ways even better.
Cool. Well, you just blew me away. I had no idea that you had any connection to Haven.
I didn't even knew Haven. It's not that widely known.
I love Haven. My wife, my daughter, and I, we watch it religiously. It's a wonderful show.
So have you been watching the third season?
The troubles are getting out of hand. Everybody's got troubles.
Everybody's got
troubles. There's troubles in Haven.
It's trouble in River City, exactly. In Haven City. We should really write the lyrics to that. We should do, now that you mentioned. No, so Haven's been – the main reason I haven't written a new book of my own in the last 3 years, and I wrote three for the line before that, is that I've been working on Haven. And if anyone's inclined, they can watch the 10th episode this year, which is one that I wrote.
All right. Well, what I was going to say is now we have to schedule and have you back very, very soon to just talk about Haven.
Absolutely.
I had no idea. I love Haven. And Eric
Balfour?
I'm sorry?
You're talking about the actor, Eric Balfour?
Yeah, he's been on here.
Oh, has he?
Yeah, he was great. We had him on the first season. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to send you that, and then you and I will schedule a follow-up.
Anytime. With pleasure. I just saw Eric here in New York for Comic-Con a couple of nights ago.
Good. And anything else we should talk about coming up soon to Hard Case you want to mention before we have to go?
So we'll know what's coming up. The 2012 line is done. Cain was the climax of the year. No pun intended for his embarrassing talk. But next year we've got four books coming. The King is one. We have a new book by Max Allen Collins that fictionalizes the witch hunt in the 1950s against crime and horror comics called Seduction of the Innocent, which will be our first book ever to feature interior art as well as a cover painting. Hmm. That'll be fun. Then we have the first new edition of Harlan Ellison's first novel to hit bookstores in 30 years. It's called Web of the City, and it's the definitive text of this book. That's the very first novel Harlan ever wrote. He's been a fan of our line for years, and we've wanted to get him into the line. And then to end the year, we have a book by a woman named Alyssa Wald called The Secret Lives of Married Women. And without going into too much detail, I can tell you it's about two identical twin sisters and a subject that fans of 50 Shades of Grey might find entertaining.
Interesting. Very good. All right. Well, folks, you can find The Cocktail Waitress, the lost final novel written by James M. Cain, with a little help from editor Charles Ardai, in great bookstores everywhere, or you can order it right now at a great price right here at MrMedia.com. Just look down here in this post, and you'll see a link to it. Down here. Let's make sure we point over to the side a little bit and not right here. Yeah. Charles, is there a website, Twitter, Facebook for Hardcase you want to share?
www.hardcasecrime.com is the website, and that's where all the new books are posted, including ones that haven't been published yet, if you want to see the cover of the King book and so on. Twitter, there is at Hardcase Crime and also at Charles Ardai, and how I divide things up between those two, I couldn't possibly tell you. And then there's some Facebook pages as well, some fan-based and some that we did. So by all means, find us anywhere online, but if you want the home, it's hardcasecrime.com.
And let's throw in an extra plug here. Haven on Sci-Fi, Friday nights, I think at 10? Is that right?
Pretty sure it's 10 Eastern anyway.
10 Eastern, yep. See, I watch. I'm not kidding.
I'm really...
Charles Ardai, thank you so much for being on Mr. Media today. Enjoyed it very much.
Sure. Look forward to doing it again.
You can see and hear almost 1,000 Mr. Media interviews by visiting our main site, MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. Or check out the more than 200 video interviews on the Mr. Media Radio site on YouTube. And I'd sure appreciate if you'd show some love for Mr. Media's advertisers, including Stitcher. Apple named Stitcher a top 5 news app of 2011. It's a free mobile app for your smartphone or tablet that lets you listen to your favorite shows and discover the best of news, entertainment, and sports on demand. You can listen whenever you want to more than 5,000 shows, get customized recommendations, and discover what your friends are listening to. My own list of Stitcher favorites is pretty eclectic. I start my day with an hour of MSNBC's Morning Joe with Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski. Then it's the latest 2-minute update from the Onion News Network. After that, I'll listen to WTF with Mark Maron, Here's the Thing with Alec Baldwin, HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher, and excerpts from E's Chelsea Lately and The Soup with Joel McHale. Also in regular rotation on my Stitcher playlist, The BS Report with ESPN's Bill Simmons, The TechCrunch Headlines, and The Don Geronimo Show. The latest episodes of each show, whether originating from broadcasts, cable TV, radio syndication, or podcasts, are continuously updated. Stitcher is a free app for your iPhone, iPad, Kindle, Fire, BlackBerry, Droid, and more. And show your support of Mr. Media by getting, did I mention it's free? The app at Stitcher.com/MrMedia. That's Stitcher.com/MrMedia. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. We're also supported by Audible. Check out Audible's 30-day trial membership and download the audiobook version of the book everyone's been talking about, 50 Shades of Grey by E.L. James. Sign up for your free trial today at audible.com/radio. Again, audibletrial.com/radio. And finally, if you need a disc jockey for a wedding, bar mitzvah, corporate event, or just a big old party, please consider calling 1-800-DIAL-DJS, the party authority for all your party entertainment needs. You can call 1-800-DIAL-DJS or go to their website, 1-800-DIAL-DJS.com, and tell them Mr. Media sent you. And thanks for listening.